Hey everyone, Jay here from Project Unity, and what a December we have had so far since James Fox first hinted that this month would be a good one for the UFO conversation. Everyone has been anticipating certain releases, and the rumor mill certainly has been churning. And tonight, I'm sitting down with journalist and co-creator of the brand new platform, The Debrief, Lieutenant Tim McMillan. Now, Tim has become a household name of late within the UFO community, with one of his most notable journalistic contributions being the publishing of an extensive UFO-related article for the platform Popular Mechanics. This was back in early February of this year, and he's also written for platforms such as Vice, The War Zone, and with the most recent announcement of a brand new media platform created by Tim McMillan, MJ Banias, and Micah Hanks, known as The Debrief. A selection of articles have followed the release of this platform, including a most anticipated piece written by Tim that brings to light two classified intelligence reports on encounters of UFOs or UAPs by US military pilots, as well as providing additional insight regarding the relationship between UFOs and our world's oceans. Now, I'm really excited to get into this. And so, without further delay, Tim, thank you for coming on the channel. How are you?
Great, Jay, man. Thanks for inviting me on. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm very happy that you're able to take some time to sit down and talk with me. There's a lot to unpack in this discussion, but first off, even though I would imagine most people who are plugged into the UFO community will be aware of you by now, for those who don't know much about you, I'm wondering if we could just kick this off with you providing some background, because I believe you were in the police force and now you're reporting on emerging topics within defense and technology, which includes the UAP issue. So how exactly did you end up on this path?
Like everything else in life, by accident. Originally when I was in college, it's a true story. I was going to college. I couldn't decide if I want to be an astronomer or a research cognitive psychologist. I just like solving mysteries. And I jokingly tell people that I showed up to what I thought was my first cosmology class, testing out a degree in astronomy. And when they told me I had to purchase like a wig and some shears and stuff, I thought that was weird. And but when I showed up to class, I realized I had signed up for cosmology and not cosmology. So I was trying to learning how to cut hair and be a beautician, and I realized I probably wasn't gonna be I wasn't gonna make it that field. But the truth of it is actually, when I was 20 years old, I had two friends who were shot and killed. They were murdered in a home invasion that I br went to school with these young men, and really senseless act. And it was a big tipping point in my life. And I don't share this very often. This may be the first podcast I've given that origin story
Wow.
to, but
Well,
I
thanks for
just
doing that.
decided to. I don't know. I think it's, if I'm going to be reporting on something like UFOs or anything, I would like people to get to know who I am, just because. Why should I listen to this dude? But yeah, I mean, that's what kind of led me. After that, I decided that I wanted to do something. I felt like it was the first time at a kind of a young age that you're faced with tragic mortality. And so I decided to be a cop. There was a brief period there where I almost went to rabbinical school and became a rabbi, believe it or
Right.
not. And so I ended up getting into law enforcement at 21 years old, and spent almost 17 years. And very fortunate, worked for a good chief of police. I worked for an agency just outside Savannah, Georgia, right there on the coast. And so I did a lot of different things, kind of my specialty in my academic background. I did finish college and did go with cognitive psychology and mathematics, of all things. And so research, cognitive psychology has always been my baby. So I did a lot of work with behavioral profiling, criminal intelligence, that kind of stuff, for a whole bunch of different like task force agencies and different things. Before finally, just after almost 17 years, just taking early retirement. I have three young kids, and it was at the point where law enforcement's a job where I wasn't home very often. And so I decided that the family was more important, so I hung that up and worked about a year as a at a private law firm as an intelligence analyst and investigator before moving to Germany here. And the UFO subject, which I'll be happy to get into. I have a bit of an origin story with that going into 2011. Back in 2011, I had my own sighting of something. And I've shared this before, but it was me and another I was another fellow police officer, but we were off duty. And we saw these five very large, very noticeably distinct white kind of antiquish yellow lights in the sky in a perfectly straight line, as if they were attached to something. And they flipped on as if somebody flipped a light switch. I mean, very noticeable. I tell people this was not one of these events where you see something in the sky, maybe a satellite, and you're like, oh, what's that? This was like, holy shit. It was very, it was,
I know that
probably as big as a pea. Yeah. Anybody that's been there, it was weird. And they flipped on and then they flipped off and then they flipped on again. And at that point they were a little bit lower on the horizon. So the ambient light of the city, you know, I'm very cautious when I say this because, you know, I understand how perception works. And so it could have been pareidolia. You know, it could have been where my mind's just trying to make sense of confusing shapes. But it definitely appeared to block out the ambient light as if it was a solid structure. So these five lights were attached to a large rectangular structure. And then the lights just cut off and it was gone. And, I still don't have a good explanation for that. But that night... I tell people it was a wonder that I didn't crash my Jeep going home because I spent the 30-minute ride back to Savannah with my head hanging out the window. Wanting to see something. I mean, you're like, oh, I want to see it. And so I was just fascinated. I don't know what time I went to sleep early that morning because I jumped on the internet and started Googling. I was like, what the hell is that? And I'd grown up, you know, and Savannah is a very heavy. It's a big military town. You know, there's an army airfield there. There's a big army barracks. It's the home of the Night Stalkers, which are the Army Special Operations Aviation Wing. The Marine base is there. There's a naval station, submarine station, not far from there. I mean, we're surrounded. And so I worked night shift for 5 years straight, and so I was very accustomed to seeing the typical flight lines and the typical what went on at night. And this wasn't it. And so I was fascinated. And I started Googling and somehow I stumbled on MUFON's website for the first time. And much to my surprise, this was back when MUFON, their case files weren't behind a paywall. And so I went to look and I was stunned to see that somebody about 30, 35 miles to the west of us had already reported exactly what we saw. Like it was, and I still don't know who that person is. Yeah. And so there's this third, you know, I had my friend with me there. She saw it, we saw it. And then there's this person I still to this day don't know, this independent eyewitness who saw it. And that's when it was like, okay, you know, I felt pretty certain I wasn't crazy beforehand. And I'm almost 100% I didn't hallucinate. But now there's this other person. So it's real. What it is, I don't know. And so I made a report and lo and behold, and found out that, believe it or not, the police chapman was the MUFON investigator.
Oh, no way.
That's
amazing.
Didn't know it. Yeah. And so that got me into the topic interested, but maybe, a little differently than some, because my real interest at that point, because that was my focus was always, I say cognitive psychology. It was really on consciousness and perception studies. And I began to really become fascinated by this idea because the mind's really a brilliant thing. And we often think seeing is believing and everything, but how we perceive things is a significant part of how we absorb reality. And people don't realize it, but our brains, you know, when there's a lot of stimuli that is always around us that is discounted by our brains. The thalamus kicks it out like a gatekeeper because it would be sensory overload. That's, recent research showing, you know, how hallucinogenics, you know, LSD or different hallucinogenic drugs, how they interact with the brain is they just throw the thalamus wide open. And so you're getting all these stimuli. So when you see a purple elephant, you know, if you're a hallucination, there may not be a purple elephant there, but there's a stimuli there that suddenly your brain's picking up and not discounting. And it brings up this question, well, what the heck is there?
I became fascinated with this. More interesting ones than purple elephants are the times where some form of deity gives people some universal information. You know, that's the ones that make me curious when it comes to psychedelics, is how are people receiving these very intimate experiences with things that seem to be external and actually present themselves as some form of intelligence. It's very interesting. Mm-hmm.
No, it really is. And if you ever read, I don't know if you've ever read any of Jeremy Narby's books. Oh, wow. Yeah, you should definitely read Jeremy Narby. He's an anthropologist. And gosh, the title of the book escapes me. But he did an entire field study with some of the disconnected remote tribes in South America and their use of ayahuasca.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's... Yeah, I highly recommend it because it's fascinating. Because just what you described, where he was mindful of how these people knew the things that they knew, and they were very direct in saying, we know them because of these ayahuasca journeys. We learn this knowledge, and they shouldn't have known otherwise.
Well, that's it. Isn't it? Yeah, that's it. I'll make a note of that.
Yeah. I think you'd really enjoy it. And so my whole journey for UFOs during the early years was how would we respond if a true anomalous phenomena, a true anomalous stimuli came into our environment? And, are we seeing something, but is it what we think we're seeing, or is that our brain's best attempt at perceiving? And I still wonder about that. I mean, I think that's, I think anybody who's looked into stuff, I often tell people to look at some of the research in, how psychosemantic linguistics play in our perception, where there's really good, robust empirical studies that show if we don't have a language or a word to describe something, then our brains kick it out and it doesn't exist. The studies about how people, there's a wealth of empirical evidence that says that human beings couldn't perceive the color blue until about 2000 years ago.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. You should check that out. I mean, it sounds crazy. Cause as I'm talking to you right now, I'm looking around, there's probably 5 dozen blue things I see. Yeah.
I wonder what the sky looked like back then.
Grayish or the ocean. Yeah, I mean, it was discovered by literature. There's no reference to the color blue in literature beyond 2000 years.
Oh, wow.
That's the basis for it. Obviously we can't interview anybody from 2000 years ago, but they didn't have a word for blue. The Egyptians are kind of the first to use it. And, if you look in Greek literature, the ocean is described as wine color. I think that still is something that fascinates me with this topic, because as you look into that, you can kind of notice there are some there's definitely some distinctive kind of correlations that make you question that, and that's kind of in how people perceive UFOs or UAP. They oftentimes follow whatever the technological paradigm is at the time. They're just one step ahead. The people probably don't realize, but you can look up the flying saucer disc shape that became popular in the 40s. And back in the 1930s, there were patents for this. Romanian inventor is the first one who filed patents for it. But the lenticular aerospace vehicle was supposed to be like, that's the shape of the future. And so if you wanted to think about a future craft at that time, that's what you'd think about. If you go back to the late 19th century, when people saw airships, they perceived them as mechanical devices.
The carrot on a stick idea, basically, right, isn't it? That's actually something I thought about as well, is just the idea that they're just one step ahead and leaving like a little trail of like technological breadcrumbs, and we're just slowly getting there pace by pace. But it makes me wonder what the end game is.
Sure. And you got me talking about all sorts of stuff I never talk on any podcast. Good for you, because now people want to hear the article
questions. But this is good. I want to dive into this first. Let's do this.
No, dude, I'm excited because nobody asked me this stuff, and so this is the side where this is not the reporter Tim. This is the the other stuff behind the scenes. We're kicking out theoretical things, but interesting. And it is, you know, what you said there, the carrot on the stick. I've thought about that as well. And what's the end game? You have to ask, is there one? Because to some extent, is it just a kind of motivator? Like it's a little helping hand that says, keep going, keep going. Because after I had my experience, I didn't read a lot of literature. I stayed away from the quote unquote UFO community because whenever you do psychology research, you want to try to be as unbiased as possible. Very difficult. But so I didn't want to be influenced by literature as much. But so I just tracked down, you know, I'll use the term experiencer in people who had sightings. But I know that, you know, because that term's kind of loaded now. It can mean people who have had very personal sightings or just a sighting like I had. And mine was all of the above there, and interviewing them and speaking to them. And it was interesting because oftentimes I found people encountered these events at a point in their life when they may have been feeling hopeless or they almost like they needed some encouragement. And I'll be the first to admit, in the case of mine, that is true. In the friend I was with, you know, for me it was a longtime girlfriend had just abruptly broke up with me. Here I am, 30 years old, a police sergeant, supposed to have my shit together, and I'm having to find a new apartment and not knowing where life's going. The friend I was with, her husband had just left her. So it was these weird instances where I encounter people where they have these experiences, and it's almost like they perceive them as something just saying, you know, as long as there's mystery in this world, tomorrow's worth it. And so I think, you know, when you say that carrot on a string, is it trying to lead us to any one place or just trying to keep us going? Because that's, I tell people, I don't know what this stuff is. If you wanted me to tell you what I hope it is, I'll be honest and say, man, I really hope it's aliens for, because I'm selfish. Because human beings have this really interesting and distinct capability that anytime we believe something is possible, we do it. And I want it to be aliens because I want to fly the cosmos. You know, I want to go visit another solar system. And so, yeah, that carrot on the string, it's possible, maybe.
I relate to what you said a lot there, actually, especially in regards to the fact that a lot of people, including myself, seem to feel that their experiences, you know, with the phenomenon did come from either like some issues that, you know, if you were having maybe some problems or something happened in your life. For me personally, I was just kind of a bit down and depressed and felt like I'd read up a lot of different types of, you know, information about quantum mechanics and metaphysics and consciousness, very, you know, on a layman's perspective, because I'm not a scientist. But, you know, for me personally, I felt like I'd kind of taken a lot of information in, but I had no idea where to go with it. And then I ended up having my own experiences where I had sightings with the phenomenon, and that led completely 100% to what I'm doing right now. And so it, you know, it put me onto a journey where I felt at some point a little bit lost and like I wasn't sure where I was, you know, meant to be going. And then suddenly the path was lined out for me, essentially. I mean, I chose to go onto it and make the channel and do what I'm doing, but essentially, none of that would have happened without that stimulus, which came from the phenomenon. And so I think a lot of people can relate to that, including yourself.
Sure. And that's where I take real exception. And you'll see me go after people sometimes on Twitter. I need to be better about that. But
We all do, Tim,
people
don't
that
worry.
I think I know, but you know, but people that I feel like put other people down for being interested in it, or you know, and I'm sure you've seen it. You see where there
Course.
people almost vehemently like, "How dare you even speak of this?" And you know, this is ridiculous. It can't be aliens. It can't be this. It can't be that. And to me, I look at it and go, "Does it really freaking matter?" In essence, if it like what you just described, if it's put you on a path in life that you're a better person, you end up doing something, and you have hope, or you see something and go, wow, you know what? We don't know all the mysteries of the universe. We don't know all the mysteries of life, because if we did, life would be pretty fucking boring. So, you know, there's more out there. And so does it matter what it is? Same thing if you believe that it's an alien spacecraft that's using anti-gravity, and that motivates someone to actually design an anti-gravity ship. Well, I don't care whether it was aliens or whatever. We have progressed as a species. So, I take extreme exception to people that, and that's a lot of why we started this platform. Anybody that tells people there's something wrong with being curious, anybody that tells people there's something wrong with considering life as not being complex, I think that's kind of a shitty thing to do.
Yeah,
that's not how we got where we are.
I agree with you. And that segues nicely into what I wanted to actually ask you, because before we jump into your most recent publications, I wanted to ask you about the latest platform, The Debrief. For those that are not aware, can you tell us how it came to be, who is involved, and what is the overall goal for The Debrief?
Sure. Yeah. No, it started amongst friends. You know, me, Mike, and MJ have been friends for quite a while. I'm very thankful for them because, you know, we're very much like siblings. And so, like, this week has been stressful. So I'll be the first to say that, you know, especially me, you know, I'll be, you know, like siblings, they can take me yelling and ranting at them. and it's all brotherly love. Thank goodness. But we wanted to do something a little different. And that's the thing. We had all, with Micah, his background, he's authored several books, but he's a podcaster, puts out a weekly podcast, three actually. So he's a professional podcaster. Me and MJ were, you know, writing articles for Vice and Popular Mechanics. And it's like a lot of writers or content creators, when you're working for somebody else, you always want to do your own thing, mm-hmm. because your editors, or the publication you're working for, they're always going to mold it in their image, and you have to write in their image. And we felt like there was a space here that was needed, that people would appreciate, which included, you know, serious, real journalism on the UFO or UAP topic. And so not sensationalized and not ridiculed. It was very frustrating for me and MJ to put as much work into writing an article on the UAP task force or something as you would any other topic, you know, that would make the front page of the New York Times or anyone else. Although I guess UAP did too, but, you know, all the political news, let's just put it, you know, all the things that people consider important. We put that time and effort, and then we would see a silly photograph go up and a silly headline, and we just groan because we're like, you know, even if you think it's silly, there's people that don't, and there's, you know, there's real government involvement here. And so we wanted to do that, but we also wanted to, you know, examine what I call breakthrough science and disruptive technology. And that was one of the things that we talked about a lot. We see this in kind of the internet and information age here. You see, you know, the social media people bickering, or you have foreign governments who use it to exploit it to try to influence other people's opinions and everything else. And a lot of that relates to not people kind of not being prepared for what is those disruptive technologies coming forward. And disruptive technology, I mean, is that it changes our entire life. This is the automobile from the horse. This is the plane. This is the internet. And so we wanted to examine that because we wanted to try to get as much of a handle on it, present that information to people. But at the same time, we wanted to cover topics that, you know, that's our mission statement is, you know, going boldly and rebelliously curious. And we wanted to present something for the people who are rebelliously curious about life, science, technology, and everything around them. Like they accept that wherever we are right now, we're not static. You know, if you just think of what you were doing 10 years ago, 20 years ago, I tell people, when I can remember as a kid being excited when my parents bought a VCR and we would go to Blockbuster on Friday night to rent a movie. Those don't even exist anymore. And so, the world is advancing, and we wanted to inspire that as well. And so, you know, it was one of these things where we felt like, a lot of the media coverage news wise was just visceral with politics and everything. And there wasn't enough that both covered innovative topics and inspired innovation. And so that's what we wanted to do. And, we're really early out of the gate, but there's a lot of things that we want to continue to do, and we're going to keep growing that platform, and hopefully we're not crazy and it's successful, and there is a lot of people who will be interested in that kind of stuff. So I'm excited.
Well,
it's fun,
you know,
so far.
Based on the reactions, the UFO community on the whole seems to be backing the effort, mate. And as we were saying before, with Joe Rogan doing the Jacques Vallée and James Fox interview, you even got a highlight. I saw the Debrief Media page was up on the TV screen, and that's going to be seen by millions of people. So no doubt you're going to get a little bit of exposure from that as well.
Yeah, no, that'd be cool. Yeah, we're gonna have to. Yeah. If anything, I've been really surprised. I almost feel like we got bigger than I expected quicker. But I guess there's worse problems that. Yeah. There's worse
Don't
problems. We've had to change
yeah,
entire
exactly.
servers.
Yeah,
we've
yeah.
had to revamp things, and but you know, it's funny because this was always going to be like, let's just do a soft launch until the first of the year. Let's dip our toes in. Let me dump this big story I've been working on for a while, and you know, let's see what happens. And you know, we're like, holy crap, it happened. Well, we've got a lot of going on, and but we're definitely going to avoid, and that's one of the things, is we're going to avoid the clickbait or quick speed. We want to do quality. And when there is news stories, because we're going to do news. And that was one of the things that we wanted to point out. And when I say news in the genre of science and technology, we will publish what we're calling debriefs. And what that is where people can kind of go to that are, they're formatted the same way I used to do intelligence briefs, where you get in a traditional article, you get the lead and the intro. So you kind of know what's going on. And then the key points are kind of bulleted for you. You get a background. So a quick background on whatever the topic is, you know, an analysis of what this new news is, and then what is the outcome from here? Maybe it's almost like a mini wiki page. And we hope hopefully that can be a place where people can come to, and where we're not breaking news, and we're not trying to compete. We're not trying to butt heads with Devices and Popular Mechanics. We're just trying to present information in that regard, in a little bit different way, but while also doing features and opinion pieces as well. So, yeah, we welcome everybody's feedback by all means. You know, check it out and let us know. Stay tuned. We'll keep growing it.
Well, yeah, a link for the description. It will be in the description for anyone listening and watching. So make sure you do check it out. And your latest article, well, you've got two articles, but the one that I'm talking about right now is Fast Movers and Transmedium Vehicles, the Pentagon's Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon Task Force. I want to jump into this. How long has this been in the works, and what kind of preparation was required? Because based on the content, I would imagine this involved a fair amount of networking, and I'm wondering if you can reverse engineer the story a bit and let us know how it came to be.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, if I gave you the ultimate origin for it, it would be 2 or 3 years. And the reason I say that is because, just like I said, I was always interested in this topic in 2011, never really dip my toes in the quote UFO community. I always just kind of stayed in this, in my own little invisible community college, if you will. But I had a good friend of mine who, and I'm very fortunate because I cover everything that we cover, and this is just the same. I do have an interest in the national security and defense community world. I kind of grew up in that world. I come from a big military family, and my uncle once served with one of the deputies on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and I grew up in this world, and so it's something that's familiar. And the police world is very quasi-military and bureaucratic, just like the government. So that's kind of the battle space I operate. And somebody from that world, when the first 2017 story came out, a couple months later, so early 2018, I remember being intrigued. But also kind of being like, why isn't anybody talking about, like, this is kind of a big mm-hmm. deal.
Me and you both.
Right. And I asked a friend, and, they work in these classified intelligence positions and everything, which sounds so much sexier than it is. It means a bunch of nerds behind computers, frankly. But, he just said, listen, Tim, this is a big story. People don't know it, but this is a big story. And it was just kind of this thing like, man, this, you might want to pay attention. And so I did. And I, shortly after I retired from law enforcement, I was like, just like I said, I want to solve mysteries. That's really my what motivates me. And I just realized that, man, I'd spent the bulk of my entire adult life solving mysteries in law enforcement and applying, you know, formal criminal investigations. I was like, I could probably do the same thing here. And, you know, what the hell? Try to bring a different kind of tone of investigative journalism that I don't know I really was seeing. And that's not to down any journalist or anybody that's doing that has been covering the topic, been covering it for years. It's, you know, just a different style. And I thought, what the hell? Let me try. And so I just, like you said, in terms of networking, people, there's no magic to what I do. And that's what's funny. And I have imagined you can relate, Jay, because I know I can remember
nodding
back
my head.
Summer. Yeah.
It just happens sometimes.
Well, yeah. And I would imagine it's just like the reason that I'm here now is I remember in the summer after you were able to interview Ralph and Leslie, and people were like, who is Jay? He's got to be a CIA spook or something, because, you know, you're like, how did Ralph and Leslie give him the interview after, you know? And I imagine, I could be wrong, you just reach out to people and say, hey, can I talk to you?
Yeah. Well, the story behind that was I was just fortunate enough to do a breakdown with a guy that knows a lot about the Wilson leaks, and they actually got hold of us and asked us if we'd be able to just take it down for a moment. And I agreed and just asked if I could have an interview for doing it. And they were like, yeah. So it was just one of those really weird circumstantial moments. It was brilliant.
Right. But there's no mystery. I mean, there's no like hidden conspiracy.
It could be my
the same thing here. Right, you're right. Well, that's what I was doing an interview this morning, and somebody asked me about that, you know, about being a counterintelligence agent. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, dude, anybody can come. It's so boring. Like, you would see me picking up dog poop in the backyard, washing clothes, bathing kids, trying to work, you know, but you're welcome to. But yeah, everything I do is just, you know, just reaching out and connecting with people and trying to get relationships of trust. And I won't lie that this, as I said, it kind of growing up in the military defense world and community, my best friend's father, my next door neighbor, was the recently retired commander of CENTCOM. He was the general who was in charge of the Bin Laden raid. So, I mean, like, I grew up around this. And so it's very normal. In language and just understanding. And so sometimes things that I see, just because when people don't understand them or they're not used to it, you know, conspiracies can arise and everything, where I would look at it and go, gosh, that's just so typical of bureaucracy. Like, there's so many different things. And so I spoke the language, I guess. And so that was comfortable for people, especially when you talk about people like Lou Elizondo, or who, you know, he definitely stepped into the limelight. But prior to that, you know, he's in this defense world. They're not in the limelight. So it's always nice when somebody speaks your language, so to speak. And so, yeah, I just worked through that and kept chipping away and, you know, making contacts and talking to people who recognize that, I hope that people recognize everything I report on, I try to do very responsibly, very accurately. I don't try to embellish. I don't inflame. I try to just be as accurate as possible. And I won't print anything or say anything that I don't think, you know, that I wouldn't be willing to testify in court to under oath. And I am honest with people, you know, so, you know, if they say I can't go on the record, or they, you know, I can't do this and that, that's fine. There's not a story worth it to me, because when somebody says that, you know, it's always, well, why? And oftentimes they have a legitimate reason, and it has nothing to do with UFOs. It's their professional job that they're in. And some people work in professions where their name comes out, their life can be in danger. You know, they work in these, you know, everybody forgets the intelligence defense world is just that. And they're not just looking at UFOs. They're keeping us safe from terrorists and a lot of things. And so, I was very fortunate and to get good relationships there. And so it really, you know, if you read that article, you're actually going with me on my journey, which we'll just narrow it down to about the last 8 months, in which comes with that, the Freedom of Information request release that I got, where I just was requesting people's emails copies of, I want people's copies of people's emails that are mentioning UAP or unidentified aerial phenomena. I'm fishing, right?
Yeah.
And I got a hook. You know, I got a fish on my line, and it was the vice chiefs of the Joint Chiefs of Staff,
yes,
of the Navy and Air Force. The vice chief of the Navy telling the vice chief of the Air Force, I recommend you take this briefing I just received of unidentified aerial phenomena. I mean, spelled out explicitly. Mm-hmm.
Point blank.
And, yeah, point blank. No ifs, ands, or buts. And saying that, that the Secretary of the Navy had just received the same brief. And again, this kind of, so this is where being familiar with this military world, my head went, holy shit, because this is the pinnacle of the United States military hierarchy here. I mean, the Joint Chief himself, is technically the pinnacle. However, it's always the vice chiefs. It's just like any business or organization you ever worked in, you might have the general manager, but the manager who's on the floor, that's the one that really keeps everything running and is in the, that's who these were. I mean, these were big people. And so this was even before they formally announced the task force and were being very cagey about what they'd say about it. And I mean, we had all indication that this was a serious issue prior to that and was being treated seriously. But you don't waste the vice chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff's time with BS. I mean, these are people who, right, you don't walk in and shake hands with the vice chief. They're going to look at you like, who are you? Get away from me. Don't touch me. I say that. I'm embellishing there. They're probably very nice people. But, these are powerful people that I can remember when my uncle worked at the Pentagon is in my youth, kind of being around individuals like that, where you walk in and like the room is, if you ever walked, somebody that you just knew, like, that's a powerful person. Like, it just feels like, mm-hmm, wow. Yeah. So these are powerful people. You don't waste their time. And so I asked the Pentagon. I have always played by the rules. And I asked them. I said, hey, I got this. Got it from you officially. I think that, I'm going to report on this. And this is a big deal. I think, can we try to line up an interview with somebody at the executive services to maybe talk about this? And it's a reasonable request, just on the same page. In the United States, in order for democracy to function appropriately, legislators are supposed to work on the implied consent of the people, mm-hmm, informed consent. And the people can't consent to legislative and political action if they're not informed. And so we knew that this task force is coming. We knew that all of these things. And from my position, it no longer was like a let's get to the disclosure or the heart of the UFO issue. It was, a moral responsibility that this is what you're supposed to do. If you're going to do anything with journalism, your responsibility is to inform the public and so that they can make sure government is acting how it should be. That's the way the system's supposed to work. And so when you shut it down, I'm going, well, I understand secrecy. I really, really do. I respect the necessity for it. I respect the fact that, I don't need to know exactly how, China hacked into our computer. And I don't even need to know how you figured that out because, I get it. Those can be secret. But the fact that it happened, or the fact that when you come and say, hey, we need to spend X amount of dollars, or we need to prioritize cybersecurity because China's posing a threat, I trust that you're telling me the truth. And I trust that, okay, you've given me enough evidence that I'm, saying as a citizen, okay, yeah, I agree with you. But in this instance, just to say nothing, I mean, it that wasn't going to work for me. And so I just started working the trap lines and calling and, talking to people to try to get an idea, like, what's going on behind the scenes? Is this a serious task force? Is this really going on? And was able to kind of work my way up into those inner sanctums. And much to my shock, people were saying, yeah, man, let me tell you, this is serious. In fact, this, this, and this. And that's how I found out about these two intelligence reports that had been issued by them.
I was just about to ask about that. I was just about to say, is there any way you'd be able to elaborate on how you like negotiated that information from active U.S. officials? Because, I mean, it did in the article, it says multiple senior U.S. officials have provided the information regarding those two classified reports. So, yeah, how did you manage to squeeze that out?
Right. Well, okay. Without giving anything too much that
would
put anybody at risk, I'll just say, I first and foremost, I want to make sure this is expressly clear, is that anything and everything that I did trying to get to that, I never, I didn't speak to people like Lou Elizondo, Chris Mellon, or anybody like that, or anybody that had a pre-existing UFO presence whatsoever. Right. That's not because I dislike them. That's not because I don't have respect for them. But rather, when you work investigations, motivation and intent is the first thing. That's one of the most important things that you want to try to determine. And I know what their belief is. I know that they recognize this is something that's important. So I know what their motivation is and I know what their intent is. But I wanted to know the truth. And so I reached out to people I'd known before I ever started reporting and was like, hey, man, have you heard anything about this task force deal? Like, what's the deal here? What are the thoughts? And, it was much to my surprise, and hopefully it was conveyed in the article, that people, their response were, holy shit, dude, you're not going to believe this. And that's because these reports had gone out. And those people, one of the quotes that I use, that's a direct quote where they said, man, decades. I've been in the IC. I've never seen anything like this. And so they were very widely disseminated. And there was this eager excitement in that world, realizing, holy shit, this is real. And we're getting this through official channels and official reporting methods that go through layers of approval. And it's coming to us like, this is going on. And so there was this equal, almost excitement on the other end, on the inside, where suddenly they were as willing to share responsibly what little they could, because they felt like, that they understood this idea that the public should know some about this, because we want the public to recognize this is something as legitimate as we do now. And that's honestly how it came about. And it was fascinating to hear that. And, there were a couple of people who were willing. There was a lot of people who were willing to confirm it. They were like, yes, that's true. But, I'm not going to take any more risk behind that.
Yeah.
There were a couple of people willing to share some details that, I definitely caveated that in the article by saying, well, A, the wide distribution of these, that I do believe there's obviously a lot more information that's at a much higher security classification. It would not be distributed like that. Mm-hmm. And B, I reasonably, honestly, truly don't believe anybody shared anything with me. In fact, I'm confident that would have been any kind of national security risk or anything that hedged on systems that collected data or anything. So there's more to those reports, assuredly, that wasn't relayed to me.
Well, I mean, nevertheless, it's extremely encouraging, to have so many people apparently excited within the intelligence community and also, just willing to go as far as they can to bring this out to the public. And you also include how one source from the U.S. intelligence community indicated that the possibility of these platforms, being of extraterrestrial or non-human origin is a possibility considered within the Pentagon's UAP task force. And although this would seem, to be an obvious suggestion based on the observed capabilities of UAP versus our own technological capabilities, my question to you is, with all the different individuals you've interacted with, both in and outside of the U.S. defense intelligence bureaucracy, is the consensus amongst those of which you've spoken with that the UAP issue is most likely extraterrestrial or at least non-human in origin?
Full disclosure, no pun intended, and just complete honesty, I never from anybody got, because I did ask multiple times, like, what is the current estimate of the situation? Mm. What is the current, what is the assessment? And what I got, I mean, first of all, that quote that I used there saying that the idea of it being non-human or extraterrestrial in origin is being considered, that was consistently confirmed across the board.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just one that said it. That was across the board. But that was an area where I had people, it was very funny. I had people who know a lot more than me who were like, what have you heard? Tim, do you think this is aliens? So, you know, they were as curious, and maybe that's frustrating for people or intriguing. And again, I can only report on what I was told or what I, you know, I knew ultimately before we went to print, these reports were 100% real. And so there may be more estimates of the situation. There may be an estimate of the situation. Almost assuredly, anytime you work in intelligence, you do have these kind of probability matrices where you go through, and if anybody's ever heard with, you know, there's no such thing as certainty in intelligence. That's very important, is because you're working, you know, science works in absolute ground truths. Intelligence works on probabilities and analysis and an attempt to kind of get a consensus idea of, and you really, your goal is to be able to say with a high degree of certainty this, but you never say with absolute certainty this unless you are absolutely certain. But you know, if you're absolutely certain, rarely is that something that's intelligence working on. So I'm sure there is a matrix and a working hypothesis. I don't know what it is. I truly don't.
Well, stepping into speculation a little bit, but you know, do you think that there is a group or some people that are aware? I'll rephrase that: are aware of the origin. Like, if you had to just judge it by your gut feeling,
I don't know, and I don't know if that's my bias in wanting to just believe, like, come on, somebody's got to know, or, you know, I'll tell you. So if I had to just go on what I know from what I was told and the impression and perception I got from everybody I was told, it was very interesting because I felt like the people examining it were frankly just as curious, excited, or frustrated as the UFO community in terms of, you know, what this is. Now, that very likely frustrates a lot of people because, you know, the unknown is a stressful thing, whether people realize that. And that's, you know, we attach meaning to the unknown to make it less stressful. So you see this with critics, and I say critics, not skeptics, because there's nothing wrong with being skeptical. But you see this with critics where they have to force everything into a pragmatic explanation, but that's because the unknown is scary. You see this on the opposite side where you'll hear people say, you know, well, we already know what it is. It's the blue avians from Zeta Reticuli. Mm-hmm. And you're like, okay, well, all right. I mean, maybe they're right, but that's, you know, that unknown is a scary place to operate in. And imagine, and I tell people, imagine, I don't know that this is the case, but imagine if you have at your fingertips the most sophisticated surveillance, reconnaissance, and just technological hardware the world has ever known, and yet you know what we know. It's real.
That's something that I've genuinely thought about myself. Yeah, that's something that I've thought about in terms of maybe one of the more likely explanations for all this secrecy isn't that they've mastered it and that they've got fleets upon fleets of different types of platforms that use anti-gravity, but actually it's more towards the fact that they still don't know. And how do you, if you are, which the Americans are, the most exquisite kind of intelligence and defense and communications apparatus in the world, how do you explain that? Because, and you know, from an outsider's perspective as well, looking in, America obviously very patriotic, very proud of their country, very proud of the military force. And so that's a big issue to address if in reality you're going, listen, folks, you know, yes, we have all of this amazing technology at our fingertips, but unfortunately, there is something that can come in at will and do pretty much whatever it wants, and we don't actually have the ability to even explain who's operating it. I mean, that's a big reason for secrecy, if there was going to be a reason.
Sure, on multiple fronts. I mean, one is the fact that at the end of the day, if you have something of unknown origin, well, you lack actionable intelligence, meaning you have no way to mitigate that threat. So whatever it is, at will, can just fly over your nuclear facility, play tag with your fighter jets.
Yeah.
That is an extreme vulnerability. And at the end of the day, you don't discuss vulnerabilities, because if you discuss those vulnerabilities, then you're bad. Your enemies will exploit them. But in the same token, you talk about stress. I mean, you know, just everything you said, I agree with. And imagine now if you or I, our entire job was defense. Our, you know, we, you know, spent 30 years of our life, you know, focused solely, you know, we went to West Point, we've prepared our life to do this, and this is the career we've chosen, it's the military. And then suddenly you're being confronted with information that's just so far, like, it's like, look, you ain't got nothing against this.
Yeah.
That's got to be a stressful situation. And I have often said that the idea, in quotes, of a cover up of better being explained by willful apathy, I think can absolutely be reality. And I can completely see those positions where you have somebody that for 40 years has spent their entire life to arrive at this moment where they got 4 stars on their shoulder and they're sitting in just the pinnacle of their career and they got like 4 years till they retire, and somebody comes and brings them this, mm-hmm. and you're going, I don't even know, like, this is not what I've spent my entire career training and understanding what to deal with. And I'm not saying that what you're telling me isn't true, but I'm telling you, I would rather you hand that to the next guy that'll be here in 4 years, because it starts attacking,
hot potato.
Like, what do I do with that? You know, do I want to be that guy or that woman that, you know, pushes this issue? Can I see that happening? Sure. You know, is that what's happening? I don't know. But you don't always need complex conspiracies to necessarily see some of the stuff that we've seen.
No, you just, for sure. Yeah. It begs the question why they're talking about it now, you know, if there's been such a, and there has been, prolonged secrecy for at least 70 years. I mean, we know that it doesn't matter about so much regarding the kind of technological movements we've made forward. We know, you know, that they have been covering this up to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
So why now?
Well, you know, I think because it's always going to arrive. I mean, here's the thing is if it's, you know, I've said 1969 when the Congdon committee report came out and they said that, you know, they just didn't see any justification in further study of the phenomena. They never said it wasn't real. They just said they didn't justify further study. Yeah. You know, that kind of just closed the book on things. And, you know, it was, if you read some of the reporting on the Congdon report, it's quite funny because, you know, in the New York Times and in the media outlets then, because they actually never reported, they never got the entire report. They reported on a leaked portion. Admittedly, they say this in the articles. They reported on a portion that was leaked to the Associated Press. And so the perception that people had of that, and there were silly cartoons and everything that came with it. And so it was just ridiculed away. And that became the perception of it. But nobody told whatever UAP are, hey, you don't exist, so go away. Because, you know, if you pick up where Blue Book left off and look in some of the civilian reporting centers, you realize, wow, statistically, it's stable. You know, it's you have the same number of sightings and unknowns or possibly misidentifications as you did in Blue Book years. Like, there's not been a tapering off. So nobody, it doesn't matter what the social climate is, nobody evidently told these things, you don't exist and go away. And so you reach a point where I think you're always going to have people that kind of come forward and I would say accurately, you say, look, guys, can we bury our head in the sand forever? You know, how long are we, is that the best thing? Because the longer you do that, if you are burying your head in the sand, whether it's willful or you're just, like you said, I agree with you. There's a cover up in the sense that you just look the other way. You don't have reporting systems in place. You don't address it, and therefore it doesn't exist. But how long does that go on? Can you do that forever? Or do you just realize
not,
that?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, if you do it for 200 years, it makes it worse because now it's, you know, it's one thing, no matter when you come out, if that's true, people are going to go, you lied to us for 70 years. You know, you can try to mitigate that and say, well, yeah, but here's why. You lied to us for 300 years. You know, like suddenly
yeah, it's slightly difficult.
Right. And so, yeah, I think you're always going to have people that say, look, no, now I think is, you know, now is the time. You know, that now is the time that they challenged what that actual recommendation of the Condon report was, which, you know, everybody leaves that part out when they discuss it, where it says, you know, that we don't see any benefit in further study. However, should advances in science occur and they acknowledge the lack of understanding that we have in certain disciplines at the time, should that change, then this recommendation would change. And so therefore, I think you're going to have people now, and that's what I perceive this as. You have people now that are saying, no, you know, that time has come where now we do have the science and technology. Yeah.
Basically, they were just saying, we can't handle this right now. We're putting the pen down. We're going to wait for a few more years, pick it up again.
Sure. And think about what was going on at the time. And that's what I'd like to remind people. You got to remember, it's a Cold War.
Of course.
You have to say, am I going to dump X number of millions or billions of dollars into trying to figure this out? But while I'm doing that, Russia's building bombers. And so, you know, you kind of mitigate what you think is important. And you know, again, if you're talking in a strictly defense world, remember that their primary job is defense. And if it's not attacking us, hey guys, I can hand it off to the next guy. So,
well, you know, speaking of picking up like where other people have left off and waiting until the time is right, have you seen the trailer for the film called The 11th Green?
No.
Oh, dude, I'll send you a link to this. It popped up on my radar because it's basically, I'll read what it says in the little description. A respected journalist, Campbell Scott, uncovers the truth behind the folklore of President Eisenhower's long alleged involvement in extraterrestrial events. And it looks really cool. And there's just a scene in the trailer where it looks like he's being shown in some underground base some form of zero point energy, or because it's a huge amount of lights being emitted. And he says, what's going on here? And they say, it's electricity, sir, obviously. And he says, well, you know, when are you going to tell people? It's like, when they're ready. So, you know, I'll send you the link. It looks really cool. I put it on Twitter and someone had sent it to me today. And it looks like an interesting film.
Yeah. Please do. Yeah. That sounds cool. And and it's funny because that's always the alternative. It's always that we say, why aren't they telling us the truth? Why are they keeping these secrets from us? And then I also think in my mind, what if they did have, quote, disclosure, and whatever the hell they tell us, everybody's like, oh my God, why would you tell me that? Like,
that's probably going to be happening, isn't it? You know, at least with some people.
Right. It's like, life was better when I didn't know. Why would you tell me
ignorance
that?
And
I
don't bliss.
Know. Right. That is very true. And I was in the police academy. I won't say his name, but there was a young man I went to the police academy with. He was the top shot in our class. You know, he was the sharpshooter. He was dumb as a box of rocks, and he was too dumb to be nervous. Mm. And so I remember when we went to the flight line, you know, we were all nervous because this is, you know, whether you graduate or not. And he was like, I'm not nervous. I've been shooting BB guns my whole life. And I'm like, you dumb bastard. But he was, you know, ignorance is bliss. And so you're right. Sometimes it is. The happiest people are the people who don't worry.
I know.
Because
they don't. Sometimes envious.
I am.
But I do like the fact that I'm plugged into certain things. I think it's really great. And it's great seeing other people as well plugged into it, like yourself.
Sure. Well, no, I appreciate it. It is fun. And that's where I see... Yeah, I purposefully keep myself somewhat disassociated with the quote-unquote UFO community, and that's not because I don't. There's not a great number of really great people that I've met through that. I've always been impressed and had great conversations and everything. I do that to an extent just to try to never. I always tell people when you're in a community, we're communal. We're pack animals. Human beings are pack animals, and so we want a sense of belonging, and we like being liked in our community. And, you know, this is a topic that is very difficult to get anything. It's very, very difficult to ever make anybody happy. I'll be honest with you, you know, and if you let, you know, the quote community's happiness guide you, then I think there's a lot of well-wishing people that get themselves in trouble sometimes because, you know, you didn't bring it up, but like the photograph that we published yesterday, and, you know, everybody was like, it looks like a balloon. And I'm like, yeah, no, it does. It really does. Mm-hmm. And everybody's like, why would you share this? Well, this was in the report. You know, that 100% confident. I mean, I'm just an arbiter of news. Like, I can't, I'm not the PR firm for the task force, you know. Like, I can't, they decide whether they're good or bad. And if, you know, it does look like a balloon, I don't know any other context behind it. But those are one of those good examples where I think if you let, you know, what is going to be the reaction when you release this? Oh, people aren't going to be happy because this isn't the triangle, photo.
You know, the thing is, though, and I've said this before, that the UFO community and the people within it, and I'm one of them, so obviously I'm very grateful of everyone that I interact with. But at the same time, the UFO community in general is oversaturated with, you know, data, but as well as that, theories and speculation and lots of different ideas. And so people are building up their expectations for what's going to happen next. And the thing is, you know, yeah, the people within the UFO community, some of them might be disappointed and say, oh, well, what's this? It looks like a balloon. But to segue back to Joe Rogan, he was talking about that. And the first thing, that was the first thing he mentioned, was that photo. He was like, and, you know, this image has been circulated around. Let's talk about that. So, you know, this is about engagement of the public and then of the academics, you know, sectors and of a wider range of demographics than just the UFO community, which is an incredible niche within different types of niches. This is still so small in our reach and our ability mm-hmm. to convey things out. And it's only just starting to really get that introductory trickle into mainstream media. So I think that at the end of the day, like, the people who are truly behind the effort of some form of disclosure should be grateful mm-hmm. for everything that's permeating out into the mainstream that's beneficial.
Sure. No, and I agree. I'd like to tell everybody and remind them, because I'm one of those people, like I said, that didn't start reading historical accounts, reading books, watching any films or anything until really the last 3 years. And so I tell people, like, listen, you know, take me for example. So I was interested after my own sighting, but then I wasn't exposed to all this other evidence and literature and all these other accounts. I grew up in the kind of paradigm that everybody does, where this topic is regulated to entertainment and sci-fi. And this could be a testament to the criminal justice system in the United States, and I'm okay with that. I'm not okay with it, but I'm saying that that is a valid point. But it is the honest to God's truth that when I started looking at some of the really well done books that have documented these cases, just I saw the wealth of evidence, and I realized, you know, you could just grab one of these cases where maybe you just had a couple of eyewitnesses and then some type of physical evidence, where there was a photograph, a video, or something. And I'm thinking, that same amount of evidence. I'm not hypothetically thinking here. I'm telling you that I have testified in court. I've worked cases, investigator, you know, homicides where people have been convicted and sent to prison for the rest of their life with equal or lesser evidence than I see here. And yeah. So, but again, it took me having to look into that and everything. And so maybe it is, you know, Joe Rogan, maybe it's the New York Times, maybe it's, you know, maybe it's somebody just tunes into your show, Jay, and they go, hey, you know, this is kind of interesting. Let me check something out.
Yeah.
Where they have that. And they go, wait a damn minute. Like,
what's going on here?
Right. Like, you've got to, either there's just this enormous volume of insane people throughout history.
And within the U.S. intelligence and defense bureaucracy.
I say that constantly to the people who are the biggest critics,
right?
Who act like, why are you covering this? And I'm like, because there's two options. Either there's something going on, or the people who are in charge of weapons of mass destruction and trillions of dollars are batshit crazy. Both of these are news stories. Either one.
Exactly. These are both issues here.
Right. Either one needs to be looked into, and whichever one it is, there needs to be something done. And so the idea of sticking your head in the sand the other way, I mean, that's silly. Yeah. It's good to see. It's very refreshing. I mean, you have a really good attitude and outlook.
Oh, thank you.
You've always seen that, and that's good. It's good to have that, you know, the kind of silver lining and realize that, you know, I don't, you know, I tell people, I don't know what their definition of disclosure is. If disclosure is people in official capacity, elected leadership, people like the Joint Chiefs of Staff, people at the Pentagon acknowledging that there are something that is, you know, a around, flying around, some type of phenomena that is out there that is extremely complex and that it can't be easily solved. Well, that's happened. I mean, that's happened. They've said it.
Yeah.
If it's the Roswell bodies and everything, I don't know. We'll just have to wait for that. I don't know that that's going to happen. It would be cool, I think. You know, I don't know. It's one of those things where you're like, they roll it out and you're like, oh my God, put it back. I don't want to know. I think anybody who's been interested in this topic for years, I hope that they take that solace in realizing that, yeah, I mean, you have senior people who are in powerful positions who are acknowledging what you have been saying is real and are really looking into it. And for me, going back to, you know, like what we do with the debrief, you know, now it allows me. So if I'm working on a story, you know, it's not even UFO. So I, you know, just recently I interviewed a program manager for NASA and a program they're working on. But because the Department of Defense, because of the whole UAP task force, because of all of this, it allows me to very easily and not feel uncomfortable by saying, hey, so what do you think about all this DOD UAP news?
Open that door.
Sure. Yeah. And people would be surprised at the number of really credentialed people with very esteemed academic backgrounds who will end up talking to me, and some even reach out, who will share their own stories or are really interested. And that's another real motivation for the debrief, because we realized there were these people that were reading, you know, the academic journals and doing the right academic thing. But behind all that, they were, you know, the same thing that made them get into the fields that they wanted to get into and contribute to science. They realized that only comes about, you only make contributions by realizing that you haven't solved all the problems and being interested and fascinated.
Well, speaking of people that have, you know, specifically reached out to you guys, and I want to just kind of circle back to your more recent article, you managed to get on record for the first time a retired U.S. Air Force Brigadier General who was also subsequently the head of RAND Corporation's Space Enterprise Initiative. Are you able to unpack what he said in relation to UAPs? Because in your article, you wrote that his responses were interesting. And from reading the article, I can see that he was against the idea that these UAPs could be related to any form of classified aerospace testing. And he was quoted to say the following: it is unlikely that the US government would intentionally conduct tests against its own unwitting military assets, going on to say to do so would require a very high level of coordination and approval for the potential safety and operational security risks. Now, this isn't like necessarily new information, as many people within the UFO community, including those who have served within intelligence roles, have said very similar things in regards to the unlikely nature of classified testing in relation to these kind of UAP incursions over sensitive sites. Like, did this individual give you any further information or give you any indication as to his understanding of the origins or what might be going on with UAP?
No, and I'll be honest with you, that was kind of, I went into it up front saying, you know, I'm not going to put you on the spot here because, and say like, well, what can you tell me about the UFOs? Because for me, you know, what he did was willing to talk to me about was the most impactful. That's what I really wanted, because, and I included some of the past interviews I did last year with Gene Petit and T.D. Barnes, who T.D. Barnes worked at Area 51 on the SR-71 program and the A-12. And, you know, so he worked on very highly secretive programs. And then Gene Petit he's really the grandfather of electronic warfare technology. I mean, he invented it. And so I'd asked them the same thing. But I wanted to get somebody. I wanted somebody from the Air Force, damn it. Because nobody from the Air Force.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. And, you know, General McClintock, I thank God I have a good editor, because I included like a paragraph of his bio. But if you go to his DOD bio sheet, I encourage everybody to, because this is a man who's had a very
extensive,
flight rated on 35 different aircraft. And so this is at the end of the day, I always tell people, I stay in my lane and I know what I know and I don't know what I don't know. And I'm not an aerospace engineer. I've never been in the military and fought fighter planes. I'm not in the Air Force. And so it's incumbent upon me to try to reach out to as many experts as possible. And, you know, he was one that I knew, you know, could adequately answer that question. So I didn't put him on the spot with UAP. I'll be honest with you. Some people might be disappointed with that, but I did. I mean, if you read the ending of my article, there's genuine exasperation in my words there, where I'm saying, I've reached out to everybody. Like I'm willing to listen to everybody, but I've not found anybody on or off the record that was willing to say, oh yeah, I think this is classified tech. Sure thing. Or they thought it was enemy provocation.
You also mentioned, because speaking of classified tech, you also mentioned retired Navy Admiral Bobby Ray Inman and his involvement as director for the National Underwater Reconnaissance Office. And Bob Inman was also director of Naval Intelligence and the NSA, as well as deputy director of the DIA and the CIA. And during a recorded phone call back in 1989 with a guy called Bob Exler, Admiral Bob Inman referred to the potentiality of recovered vehicles being made available for technological research outside of black programs. And in response to Bob Exler's question about whether these types of programs and their R&D data would one day become available outside of these classified circles, the Admiral Bob Inman was quoted to say, I don't know. 10 years ago, the answer would have been no. Weather time has evolved and we're beginning to become more open to it. There is a possibility. Now, Bob Inman also went on to become president of Science Applications International Corporation, or SAIC, over in San Diego. And one of the company's primary areas of research was, and you know, maybe still is, gravitational propulsion systems. Do you think Admiral Bobby Ray Inman is a gatekeeper for the UAP portfolio as it relates to government programs and technological acquisition? He seems so read in.
I would assume that he knows a lot. We say a gatekeeper, I don't know, but I would assume that he knows a lot. And in fact, in my article, I couldn't name him, but there's a quote where I'm discussing the idea of USOs, and I reached out to someone who I've known for a long time, and you know, so way back, and someone I trust basically implicitly. Say a family friend, and that's as far as I'll go, but I know that they are involved. I mean, they have been involved or were involved with underwater reconnaissance, with an agency, a three-letter agency. Like, that was their specialty for many, many years, going all the way back to the recovery of the Russian K-129 sub. So the Glamour Explorer event. So super, super ultra secret. And that's how, you know, I said underwater stuff is uber secret.
Yeah, it seems to be. Because he denied it, didn't he? He denied the existence of the National Underwater Reconnaissance Office, Bob Inman, that is.
Mm-hmm. Bob Inman. Well, and the U.S. government does. The U.S. government will not talk about it.
Is there
it
anything
does not
else
exist.
You can tell us about Neuro? Like, are there any other details you've been made aware of regarding the agency?
No, other than it's real. I don't even know. I don't know if it is a subordinate agency to the NRO.
Right.
Or whether it is a liaison office between the CIA and the Navy, much like the NRO was in its inception, or is it a standalone agency branch? I don't know. The person that I reached out to would know, but they wouldn't tell me. But I did ask them about this idea of fast movers, and they said yes. They said, the quote that's in there is accurate. They said, on occasion, there are detections of ultra-fast, non-cavitational objects under the ocean. They said, that is accurate. And I was like, wow. And, here's an Easter egg for your show, because I didn't put this in the article. There wasn't really a good place to fit it in there. But obviously, you tell me that, and I'm like, wow, what else is there going on? And, they're uber cautious about anything, obviously, this classification wise. So even they've been in the business that long and they're out of it now, they're still bound for life. And they just said to me, I said, this is crazy. I said, so now, because in that second, and just for anybody who hadn't read the article, because I think I glossed over it, but that second intelligence report was really focused on this idea of water, unidentified submersible objects, or quote, transmedium objects, which is objects operating in and out of the water. It's so fascinating. I mean, this opens up a whole new world, maybe not for people who've been in this for a long time, but for me, I'm like, holy cow. And so I talked to them about that. I said, this is what I hear that the task force is very, very interested in. They're leaning in this direction. And, you know, they didn't tell me anything other than they just said that, you know, they mentioned very enigmatically. They're like, you know, back in the 70s, we at Duke University, and it's in the movie The Abyss. Somebody shared it after my article. I thought, huh, that's funny. That, but it's true. During the Duke University, we, you know, we sponsored research study in, you know, trying to do what we, you know, trying to see how you could get human beings to breathe liquid water. So, you know, you breathe liquid. Believe it or not, it is possible. But there's the problem is not actually getting people to breathe liquid. It's when you reverse the process. It's reverse drowning, and causes pneumonia and all these things. But they were legitimately trying this back in the 70s. And the reason for that, because you think, why the hell would you want to do that? It has to relate. It relates to the ability for human beings to go down to certain depths underwater and pressure. And so, you know, if you're breathing liquid, you can survive at lower depths than if you're required a supplemental oxygen. They just said, you know, it's just curious. Why would we ever want to do that? And that's where they left it. And so I haven't got a chance to follow up on that. You know, it could just be one of those. I try never to read too much into stuff. You know, it could just be one of those interesting comments they make. I mean, God bless them. Anybody, you know, anybody who knows anybody who's worked in the intel world their entire life, they tend to be weird because they're used to secrecy, and I mean that lovingly. But they're used to speaking in riddles, and so it could just be one of those weird little thoughts that comes up. But I haven't got to look at that. But the fact that they mentioned that in the conversation, and it did spurn this journey. Maybe it's just a cool tech story we'll run with a debrief. But it does make you wonder, like,
Well, yeah, it
why the hell
does.
were you trying to do that?
I
You know,
mean,
why?
speaking of USOs, to quote your article, it says regarding the overall theme of the recent reports, officials who read it say the report primarily focused on unidentified submersible phenomena or unidentified transmedium vehicles capable of operating both underwater and in the air. The three officials we spoke with said the report suggested the UAP task force appears to be concerned that the objects being termed as UAP may be originating from within the world's oceans. Strange as this may sound, the idea of USOs or unidentified submersible objects is not something exclusive to the current UAPTF. Have you been given any indication by official sources that there are permanent underwater bases on our planet?
No,
No.
no, I didn't know, not even hints like that. And how I termed it in the water, where I, you know, or excuse me, in the article in the water, how I termed it in the article is accurate, where I said that just based on the inherent, very classified nature of underwater surveillance stuff, that was really as far as anybody was willing to go. And I don't know what more might have been in there. I doubt, based on the distribution, that you would have seen top secret or secure compartmentalized information. I'm sure that exists, and I'm sure that it's in much tighter knit circles. But I did not get anything like that. The gist seemed to be more like, you know, this rather than underwater bases, like people think, like Atlantis, but potentially this is a persistent but transient phenomena under the water. So it doesn't stop moving. It's kind of like fish. It doesn't need to have this giant underwater base as much as it's a transient thing, but it maybe spends most of its time and comes and goes from water. And examining that, Jay, it became, you know, so I'm like, oh shit, now I got to learn about the ocean.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Yeah, and it was really, I spoke to a marine biologist, and I said, you know, I asked him about the weird stuff that goes on down there or in the oceans, and they were like, you know, this is not hyperbole, but we have more, we know more about and map and know more contours about the planets in our solar system
Yeah.
than we do about 75% of our ocean.
Which is
And
a
suddenly you're like,
mind-blowing.
yeah, because you're like, oh, somewhere there's some sanctity in the unknown coming from afar and visiting.
Oh, but yeah, but like, in the ocean. It's like, it's you're here? Just next door to me. I was swimming above you. Like,
right? Yes, it becomes it's more intense. Yeah. You know? Yeah, suddenly it brings in all these other just real theories again. So I don't want to say I have any evidence to support this, but this idea, which I think there is now evidence to support that there is a nuclear interest. There seems to be some kind of connection with nuclear energy. And you know, often people say that's because, you know, it is extraterrestrials and they don't want us to blow up our planet. Maybe that's true. I don't know. Or you look at that and go, or maybe they're like, I don't want you to blow up our planet. You're going, oh, crap.
Yeah, true. Yeah. And also, I mean, you think about how many issues we're having with pollution in the ocean. I mean, who knows if this is in some way interfering with their existence here as well. If they are basically in a continued state of being in our oceans, then I don't know, perhaps there is a biological element to this that is affecting them.
Sure. Well, there's always, and this is the thing, I don't think I've brought this up before, that, but it is in my mind. This is something that I consider a plausible, something to examine is, you know, we've seen these sightings that we're familiar with right now, and especially because you have the Navy involved and now you have this water component and they're happening off of the coastal United States. And I think people perceive that, and especially you look at the Nimitz incident, and they were right there by San Clemente Island, which is a super uber top secret naval facility. And it's like, well, clearly, guys, duh, they're right there where they'd be testing classified aerospace platforms. And that's a good, you know, theory. Okay. And, you know, that's not baseless because of where they are. But when I was just unable to find any evidence that would support that, including but not limited to the fact that we have to accept that we don't see any transition technologies here. And so the idea that it being a classified technology, no, they didn't just overcome, you know, one thing here. Mm-hmm. We're talking about, you know, the
total breakthrough.
I mean, the B-21 Raider, which is the next stealth bomber that we know exists, but it's you know, in it's what's called an acknowledged SAP, or the B-2 stealth bomber. It's cool. It wouldn't fly without computers. But at the end of the day, it still operates on the same principle that the Wright brothers developed, which is lift, drag, angle of attack, you know, propulsion. It's the same concept. And in these cases that people have, these, you know, acute angle turns, you know, rapid acceleration, no sonic booms. We're talking about
shift.
Yeah, multiple breakthroughs. And so I look
at a lot of people think it probably comes from a single technology as expressing in different facets.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it would be just a, you know, what I discussed earlier about disruptive technology, this is disruptive on steroids. Yeah. Like this is, you know, but you look at those locations. And sometimes, you know, a good friend of mine, Dr. Thomas Glass, is retired now, but was one of the leading epidemiologists at Johns Hopkins and formerly at Harvard, actually was there with John Mack of the abduction research fame. Great guy, interested in this subject, you know, leading epidemiologist, wouldn't believe it. But he, you know, we had a conversation one time about this, and he brought up something, you know, just brilliant. And he pointed out, and he's right. And it's that the problem sometimes when we ask questions is we assume that there's this binary outcome, and that's how science works. You know, right, you test a hypothesis, you know, is this alien? Does the evidence say yes or no? But what happens when you, and this happens oftentimes, that you arrive at a conclusion that is both yes and no. So it's not, there's not a single choice outcome. Now that, what that ultimately means. And I think I do believe it in this case. It means that your true answer lies beyond the hypothesis. You're asking the wrong question. And so I looked at that same thing that I was just saying about where these incursions are happening. And I went, okay, maybe this is classified technology. Maybe that we're seeing this uptick in activity. Maybe there is classified technology at play here, but it's not the aerospace, it's something else that has excited, you know, enticed, lured the boys to the yard, however you want to look at it. Like, could we be employing some kind of a reconnaissance platform off of our coast that's using, whether it's some kind of radiation technology, something, you know, who knows? And could whatever that is have excited things. And so your uptick in sightings has to do with the fact that they're, you know, maybe we are causing them unintentionally. I don't know, but to me that's just as plausible, potentially more plausible than the advanced aerospace, because you know, we don't see those intermediates. We do know, they ended it in 1989, but we had SOSIS, it was a big sea fence over the continental U.S. So we would know when the Russian subs were coming in. Well, they ended that in 1989. Well, I doubt they just gave up on homeland defense. That's that real big mystery. Like I said, if we're going to take this topic underwater, that brings up a whole new can of worms. You talk about classified technology.
I completely agree. And because, I mean, you know, you think about the U.S. Navy and all of the advanced sonar and radar and the things that they are developing now, where they can penetrate much deeper and basically uproot more stuff. I mean, you're filling out the blank spaces in the map. And since so much of it is the ocean, then it could very much be the fact that they're struggling to hide now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, the U.S. Navy accounts for 50% of the black budget. People don't realize that, but you know, it accounts for 50% of the black budget, and there are classified secure access programs that are acknowledged, but we don't know what that technology are. So we just know the code name. But you can look in the budget. There's programs like Chalk Eagle, I can't think of the other names, but there's a couple. Chalk Eagle being the one that's coming off the top of my mind, that they go back at least to the mid 90s, early 90s. We're talking about trillions of dollars.
Yeah.
I don't have a clue. Well, we say we don't have a clue, but again, it's hard to hide an advanced aerospace platform. And I think somebody posted a picture of the new RQ-170 or 180 on Instagram the other day, because they flew past them on a test flight. You know, the submarines that we know about, yeah, they're really 1980s technology. But what the hell don't we know about? It's easy to hide stuff underwater. So, you know, you're right. Could we be employing some really exotic underwater technology that doesn't account for those sightings, but rather it accounts for something? Yeah, I think that's a possibility.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, what I was saying with that as well is it could still be an anomaly. It might not be a US asset or another country's asset. It could still be something that we don't understand, but we're just basically, because of our abilities to survey the oceans and that ability is advancing, especially in the US Navy, that basically they're just not able to hide from us anymore. So it might be uprooting whatever is hiding in our oceans, whether that be some sort of classified test. But I doubt that the US Navy would accidentally end up, you know, revealing their own classified tests. It just seems a little counterintuitive. But, you know, I don't know. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, you hear people say, well, this is all a disinformation campaign.
Yeah.
And there's a lot to unpack when people say that, because there's legal ramifications. Because everybody will bring up, when you say like, yeah, but that's a pretty, you know, A, it's illegal, it's political suicide. And people are like, but what about MK Ultra? And you're like, that was bad. I agree. But you got to take everything in context. And so not only do you look at the era that occurred and the difference in the ability to kind of hide information more and the lack of oversight, more importantly, but also recognize that it was, you know, MK Ultra, as many bad things as they did, and frankly, we don't know them all, it's very localized in that, you know, it's not hard to hide one example where they're doing the brothels where they're drugging people. That's not hard. It is a little more difficult when you're talking about hiding the logistics, the manpower, and the money for a secret space force. And so the more difficult it is to hide something, the less likely someone is to engage in illegal activity, period. So you have this legal idea there, and in political suicide and everything else we could say with it that makes it hard to swallow. And then you would have to examine that the conspiracy for every one of these pilots that come forward, for every one of these elected leaders that come forward, for every one of these, just, you know, everybody that comes forward now in this official capacity, even the Pentagon spokespersons, they now become complicit or a party to a conspiracy that is growing in such a grand scale that, frankly, I would be just floored and impressed if they could pull that off. Because anybody's had to call the IRS because there was a problem with their taxes or just deal with the federal government, you realize where are they hiding this level of competency and sophistication? And that's not – I'm not speaking poorly about anybody who works in government. God knows I have respect for everybody. But it's particularly those. You know, my wife works for the DOD. She's a teacher, a school teacher. But, government is known for just bureaucracy to the point of cumbersomeness and they do dumb things. And so this idea that they would be capable of certain things would be – just marvel. I mean, that would be impressive. And then, then you have to say, okay, well, fine, we're going to accept that indeed they are, this is going on. You know, this is, they are able to pull this conspiracy off. And then you go again, what I said, that first on a, investigative standpoint, motivation and intent. And so if the motivation and intent is to hide a secret classified program, you go, well, I don't understand. So you're trying to hide a classified program by making a huge deal and pointing out something that people weren't looking at beforehand? I mean, that's just, isn't that counterintuitive? I mean, you look at, let's say, the Nimitz case. That video leaked out in 2007, and people were like, oh, that's BS. That's a hoax. And it got dismissed. And so what? You decided years later, all right, guys, we're going to bring up the thing that nobody's talking about. And we're going to say it's aliens hide what it really
is. What's your thoughts on the private sector and a subversion of government oversight and the idea that the government is ignorant and has no idea that there is potentially, that maybe this bifurcation occurred decades ago at one point, like astronaut Edgar Mitchell says that he believes that it was most likely government at one point, but perhaps not so much today, that knows about these things. What's your opinion on the private sector holding most of the information and the government being kind of clueless?
Now that is more likely. I mean, I'm not saying that it is, but if you had to compete the two as to who would be capable of a massive cover-up and even capable of engaging in some of the behaviors that you hear, you know, the Men in Black stories or, you know, harassment or, you know, just, you know, doing whatever's necessary to cover things up, the private sector all day long, because they don't have the same regulations. They're streamlined.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. They don't have, I mean, just look at, a good one to look at, is Monsanto. If you're familiar with Monsanto, look at the things that they have done or did, especially when they were being sued for those Roundup cases. I mean, we're talking about sophisticated information warfare and, you know, psychological and or intelligence operations that would rival any state government. And they are able to do that without getting a judge's order to sign off on it, without having to do all of the different things that the government has to, all that red tape and oversight. You know, they can do things like in Monsanto's case, hiring firms like Hakkaluk, who is, you know, the UK equivalent of like Blackwater. And they can hire other countries' private forces. If you're talking about the ability for somebody to do that, private industry would. And it also raises this very interesting thing because, like in my Popular Mechanics article, that was one of the big things that I pointed out, that how that whole ATIP or OSAP study was initially hidden was behind proprietary. You know, it was, Bass and Bigelow were looking at UFOs, but that was the proprietary information. They were delivering a product that the government asked for. So the open-facing product didn't show you what they were examining to get there. Proprietary information, the government is not legally allowed to share. And so there's no FOIA for that. That is, they get around that in a lot of things. It's called carve outs. And that was, when I looked at that whole, how they ran Bass, I was what mostly impressed me was, wow, you usually see this in intelligence operations or covert and clandestine operations, carve outs where they get these little shell companies. I was like, you don't see any UFOs. At least I didn't think you would. And so, yeah, the private industry has a lot. And so the idea that somebody made a decision to put it in the hands of private industry and the government lost control of it, that could be real. Especially if you're looking at, I've made this comment plenty of times on Twitter or publicly before, but it's always intrigued me, the Atomic Energy Commission, which mm-hmm. ultimately became the Department of Energy.
Yeah.
And I think you've covered that. You've looked at some of those documents.
There's some really mm-hmm. interesting stuff there. DOE needs to be looked into a lot more.
Sure. And the Atomic Energy Commission was civilian. Yeah. So the agency that was in charge of all of the United States nuclear weapons were civilian and up until 1978. And so you look at that and think, well, from its inception. So let's play hypotheticals here that something truly exotic or otherworldly or whatever crashed in 1947, and the decision was to put it in the hands of the Atomic Energy Commission, newly formed in 1947, coincidentally. That's a private entity, and so when it closes down and it ultimately becomes a federal government agency in the DOE, all of that information that could have been accumulated from 1947 to 1970, I think it was actually shut down in 77 or 76. But during that time, they can take with them into whatever private industry sectors they want to.
Yeah, and, exactly.
There's if you look at the Clinton commissioned a study during the first term of his presidency, I believe it was the human effects and testing, radiation testing. Right. So it was to look at what did the Atomic Energy Commission do. And Annie Jacobson points this out in her book and says that even then, as the president, there was certain information that they did not provide because they said it was proprietary. And the government doesn't have, it's going to take them passing legislation or getting the Department of Justice involved to kick in doors. So it's a long way to say that realistically, if there is something like that out there, the idea of it being in private industry rather than some hangar on a military base, to me, is much more plausible. Yeah,
I would agree with you. To segue back to some more about the article, one thing that you mentioned was that last fall was a busy period for the UAPTF, with a briefing being conducted on October the 21st, 2019. That was for the Pentagon's several Senate Armed Services Committee staffers, with a subsequent meeting occurring 2 days later at Capitol Hill with staffers of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee. And you go on to say that attendees at the meetings told you that they were briefed on highly sensitive categories of UFO investigations. And I'm assuming not too much was said in regards to specifics, but are you able to expand on any further details regarding these categories of sensitive investigations? Does that include underwater as a sensitive category?
Let me say, I can't expand on it because that was the kind of direct quote. They didn't expand on it for me.
Right.
And so I'm not entirely sure what that was. Other than I'm trying to be careful here because I don't want to get anybody in trouble. I don't think they would be, but there, that particular section of the article, let me put it this way. There was a correction that I made this morning because initially when the article came out, I attributed Dr. Hal Puthoff to those meetings.
Right.
And initially when we had spoken about it, he told me, he was there. He's briefed the staffers on numerous occasions and his quotes are in there. And then later late last night, he said, I realized that those October meetings that I specifically dated, he said that was Eric. So Dr. Okay. Eric Davis is the one who was there. And so that's who was there. I have briefed him on numerous occasions and that I verified that, not just from Dr. Puthoff. And so, without getting anybody in trouble because they're not supposed to talk to the media, I'll just say that those dates coincide with the same link that I included there, which was the New York Times article that was published in July. And so, those conversations came from Dr. Davis way back before he even started with his new company, but he did not elaborate. But so now Eric, we know.
So Eric Davis did do those those meetings, because I remember I put up a tweet saying that a while back, linking the New York Times articles, and I got jumped on quite aggressively by a few people who said that that he didn't do that. And I believe, if I'm getting my situations right, someone was actually emailed by Eric Davis who apparently confirmed that he didn't do those meetings. So has he changed his tune on that?
I got jumped on.
I got put into a video by John Greenwald.
Well, I am, you know, Dr. Eric Davis is not allowed to speak to the media in any official capacity with his job, which is like most jobs, just everybody's clear. It doesn't have to do with UFOs, but a lot of places that deal with defense contracts and everything. However, yeah, it was confirmed not just from him, but from others that the October 21st and 23rd meetings that I referenced, they were provided by Dr. Davis in terms of what was in the context of them. So to expand on your real question there about those sensitive topics or anything, we did not expand on it when we spoke almost a year ago, but he definitely did in the New York Times article. And so I would imagine that, you know, when he told Leslie and Ralph that it had to do with the crash technologies, that's what he would have been referring to when we spoke then about the sensitive stuff. And I did ask, you know, I didn't expand on it more, but I did ask Dr. Putoff in terms of, you know, because I knew I had confirmed he had conducted several briefings with staffers, and he confirmed it as well. And I did ask him if he ever gave any briefings to staffers in relation to crashed technology, crash materials of any kind. And he told me, you know, just as kind of a general topic, but nothing specific. So he didn't give any crash briefings. So yeah, I mean, that's all I know, unfortunately, there. I wish I knew. That's the thing. I think somebody, you know, I saw somebody lamenting today about, I'm sick of insiders who won't tell us what they know. I was like, listen, trust me, I feel your pain. Like, I report everything that I know to believe true. You know, I don't withhold anything. Unless
I think a lot of the insiders feel that pain as well. I mean, you look at Christopher Mellon and people like that, they're frustrated. They want to be able to speak more candidly.
Sure. Well, and that's the thing, you know, it's such a complex problem because it's multifaceted. It's where you've got to examine just the national security apparatus in general, like what is warranted secrecy and unwarranted secrecy. And, you know, I think that some of those individuals, who don't share a whole lot, but they may feel like, you know, whatever they can't share is unwarranted secrecy, like it's important information to the public. And that's tough. You know, it's a tough situation to be in.
It is, yeah.
That's that flip side of the coin. It's kind of like, well, you know, I think anybody who's had that thought experiment, maybe sitting around with their buddies drinking a beer or something and been like, you know, if they brought you in and said, listen, we'll tell you everything, you know, Roswell, the whole nine yards, but you can't ever tell anybody the rest of your life, man, that's, I think a lot of people are like, screw everybody else. But man, you think about it.
I'd struggle.
What if they do? Oh man, what if they lead you in the hangar and there it is? Like it's like the Star Wars with Han Solo. It's true.
Exactly.
It's all true.
It's all real.
And you're like, there's a burden of having that, I think, because what good is a secret that you can't tell?
No, you know, you have to see it from both sides of this, you know, because obviously these people are human beings at the end of the day as well. And if you can imagine the compounding pressure of having that implication on you, then surely they must really be feeling it, you know. One quick question. How are you doing for time, Tim? Because I've got a couple more questions for you if you're quite happy to soldier through.
Sure. Probably got like 15 more minutes if that's cool with you, just because I got to call somebody else before it gets late. But yeah, that's, yeah.
Well, yeah. That, That's fine, man. No worries. 15 minutes. In that case, let me get down to a couple more questions. Because in the article, you mentioned how two intelligence officials told you they were made aware of the UAP reports and images via the use of the NSA's official intranet, known as NSA Nets. And there's been some connections drawn from this regarding the possibility of data sharing on the UAP issue via Yakuza and Five Eyes Alliance, which would include my own country, the UK. This specific connection was highlighted by Andreas in an article for the site The Unidentified, and it seems to be based off of the fact that a software tool called Info Workspace, or IWS, which was created to exchange basically information between NSA, the US military, and partner countries during Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan, that the IWS software may be utilized to obtain UAP data from our American allies due to Five Eyes being a signals intelligence agreement and IWS being a signals intelligence software. The idea is that IWS ran or possibly still runs through NSA Net. If this is the case, then it opens up the possibility of information sharing on UAP data between Five Eyes domains via these secure channels. Do you think that's likely happening, or do you think that they're probably not sharing that type of data?
First of all, let me just say I'm always so impressed, and I was still a certified police instructor, and I used to be an adjunct instructor in Teachi Ogeechee Technical College. I taught investigators, and sometimes I look at the UFO community, and when it comes to open source investigations, I'm like, there's people out here that are every bit as damn good as anybody I've ever seen, and the fact that people pick that up, I'm like, wow, I'm really impressed. And because it's accurate, and yes, no, to bluntly answer that question, yes, I do believe that these reports and information were shared in networks in which they're disseminated to specifically the Five Eyes, which is New Zealand, Australia, Canada, the UK, and the US, obviously. And I do believe that they went through those type of channels. The type of reports they are reports in which you do share with your Five Eye partners, because you want them to be on the lookout for that. And interestingly enough, I think because we have the comments in the public domain, I believe that I would say with a very high degree of certainty that Japan has also been briefed. Outside of that, I'm not sure, but you know. The U.S. has definitely, I think, to what degree, I'm not sure, because every country has in the U.S. it's, not for foreign nationals, top secret information. And so anything that has been collected on systems of that caliber, so the systems themselves are just, we even keep from our allies, that data wouldn't be shared. But I think the idea of letting our allies know this is serious, we're looking into it, has been done, and which is encouraging because the reason that you do that is because you realize, these intelligence briefs, when they're put together, right, for people that don't realize it, they can be put together by dozens to hundreds of analysts. It's kind of like a wiki page. And so everybody adds their info because you want to try to get as much and the most accurate picture you can of whatever the issue is. And so, it's encouraging, and I could see why they would want to do that because, whatever these objects are, they almost assuredly, they're not American citizens. They don't have, why would they stay in America? So it's a global type, I say problem, and not that it's a problem, it's problematic, but it's a global issue. And so, yeah, you would want your partners to you'd encourage them to help share and help look at it with you. So yeah, I think absolutely that there's no doubt in my mind that I think especially that with that NSA net. So the counterpart to the NSA in the UK would be GCHQ, and the similar counterparts in Australia and Canada and New Zealand. And I think so. I'm glad that got picked up so easily. So I think, that's one thing about the UFO community. It's an international community. We have,
Absolutely.
we have great, people like Keith Basterfield in Australia. We have all these people, my own partner MJ's in Canada. And so hopefully, they can start, leveraging what they can in their own countries to see what we can find out. And or leverage their countries to say, hey, look, the US is taking it seriously. at least do the same little bit
yeah.
that they have done to your own citizens.
You also included two quite famous videos of UAP as references in your article. Mm-hmm. The first being a UAP recorded in 1994 over the Nellis Range in Nevada, and the second being the 2013 Puerto Rico UAP captured by U.S. Customs and Border Protection aircraft. Can you explain why you chose these videos specifically as ones to highlight?
Yeah, sure. What a good question, man. Dude, you're a top-notch interviewer, man. I'll give you that. Well, first of all, Aguadilla, because they're, and I understand it, if you look on that in the description, because we uploaded them to our YouTube channel so that we could add kind of the description. So we wanted to try to be as responsible because, that one, there is some people that offer dissenting opinion. It's a balloon and blah, blah, blah. But, the SCU has done a really good analysis. And I think it, in my opinion, it still remains in the realm of UAP, is that I've not seen a compelling explanation provided yet. But it does, debatably, because some people say it doesn't. But there is some indication that that object in the video goes into the water and then out of it without it doesn't show any kind of impact. It's not, it doesn't show the normal force that should happen when you
always
hit water.
Always blows my mind when you see that.
Yes. And so,
no dispersion because of water.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's, and you just think about it when you jump in a pool, just the mass and acceleration. Mm-hmm. and you don't see that. And so, since we're talking about transmedium, I thought that was a good one to highlight so that,
definitely.
Brings up that discussion. The Nellis Range one, that was one I just was glad to get out there more because it is an older video from 1993. And if you look at the video on our YouTube channel, I made sure I linked. There's been some really phenomenal analysis. Somebody created an entire webpage.
You did a good job linking those things. That was
They did great work. And mm-hmm. That video actually was someone you've interviewed, a very good friend of mine, Nick Cook.
Nick Cook's great.
I love Nick. And a year ago, he mentioned it to me about saying he remembered seeing it and how it reminded him of the Tic Tac. And then, just a couple months ago, so a year later, he was like, I found it. And so then he sent me the whole 12-minute video. And I thought it was one that, it's one of those ones that's kind of been lost over time. But it's very interesting and compelling video when you watch it. And for me, I encourage anybody to watch it because there's a couple of reasons in terms it does. Nick was right. It does seem very reminiscent of the three videos that we've seen recently.
Exhibiting like some amazing characteristics. Like mm-hmm. the thing, the videos that we've seen recently are amazing, but they are tame in comparison to these two videos. And it's just, it's incredible that you have stuff like that just floating in the underground. Because I saw that Nellis Range one years ago. It just floats around on YouTube, and mm-hmm. And then you get drops like this from the Navy, which are undoubtedly impressive. But hey, we've had stuff like on record that's doing insane things for a while now.
Yes, in that particular video. What I was really and still fascinated by is you see it, you could say that its maneuvers are characteristic of like a racing drone today, where it zips to the side at one point mm-hmm. and it'll zip back and forth. That was and still is some of the most compelling things that I heard from, one of Commander Fravor's wingman during the Nimitz incident. Was when she talked to me about how the object was bouncing around like a ping pong ball. And still to this day, I find that some of the most compelling pieces of evidence because it, I'm a human behaviorist. And so, even if we're going to develop advanced systems or technologies, they're going to be developed by human hands. And so they're going to behave in a way that makes sense to us. But bouncing around like a housefly doesn't make sense. And so you see that object do that. It does erratic movements. Like, why is it jumping to the side and then jumping back? And so that video is really interesting. I'll say in addition that I ask around about it and somebody who should know is kind of actively in this space and what we see with these current examinations So that video is authentic. And so they said, that's a real video. And so I think that, you know, I think that the providence behind it, and I highlight that in our notes on the channel, I say that the providence is dubious. I agree, you know, that how it kind of leaked out and then somebody sold it to Inside Edition. But I was told it was authentic, and you know, anybody who watches it, and, you know, I'm sure Mick West will dangle a peanut in front of a camera and show what it's doing. But that's okay. Yeah. Maybe he can describe it. But to me, I'd love to see somebody describe it, because I see that and I'm like, wow, but what is that?
Yeah, 100%, 100%. Last two questions, if you'll indulge me.
Sure.
Awesome. First off, have you had the opportunity to read Frank Milburn's paper published on BASER, which was focusing on the UAP issue as it relates to science and national security?
I have not, all the way through. Frank has reached out to me a couple of times. Frank's a great guy.
Yeah.
And it just happened to come out at a really bad week for me in terms of free time. And so I have not. I mean, you know, what little bit I've seen superficially, it's impressive to see anything come out in an academic type format in a policy journal. And so I'm looking forward to it, but I haven't had a chance to really go through it.
Yeah,
and,
no worries. Yeah, I'd recommend it. I think your article and Frank's paper, at the moment in terms of things that are currently happening, definitely the most worthwhile reads. And both of you got shout outs from Christopher Mellon, which says enough on its own, really.
That, listen, people don't realize, you know, I hope Chris listens to this. In fact,
I hope so. He follows me on Twitter, so he might be listening.
I'm going to email it to him because I want him to hear.
I really want to get him on record. If you can encourage him and say that I'd be a good interview, I'd be so grateful.
I definitely will that. And I'm going to share this with him so that he hears me say that. Yes, I was really honored when he did the retweet, because I like Chris. Chris is a good guy. I've talked to him a lot, and you might have seen me say on Twitter that my favorite quote from the Phenomena movie was when he said, you know, frankly, you know, to be honest with you, I was a little disappointed in the New York Times article, and I laughed so
I
hard
laughed as well.
But that's like anybody, like, and I know it's not like he's not mean. Chris is a great guy. I do like him, but any article I've ever written, the feedback, you know, he's like the dad you can never make happy. He's always been like, yeah, no, good article, great work, but, you know, this was wrong.
Better.
You know, you could have done better there. And so when he said that, I laughed, because I was like, he's always been disappointed in me too. So, but it really is. I hope people realize when I say that, it's lovingly, because he's the kind of guy that you want to work for if he's your boss, because the guy that demands you to be more. Like, he's not satisfied with mediocrity. So, but when he retweeted that, I was like, all right, cool. Thanks, Chris. I appreciate that. So, I'll definitely email him, whenever you publish this, and say, hey man, give this a listen.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to try and get it out for Saturday. So, not long at all. Last question I've got for you, by the way, and I was typing this up literally 5 minutes before we jumped on, because I was listening to the Joe Rogan podcast with Jacques Vallée and James Fox. And Jacques talks about his feelings regarding the phenomenon as simply a threat. And although he clearly states his support for the UAP task force, it seems he's also quite wary of the fact that the task force is operating under the idea of this being a threat. So do you agree with Jacques Vallée when he says we must not simply view the phenomenon as a threat, and that it is so much more than this? Do you share that view?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I have no problem saying that I view this as a complex issue, complex phenomena, any way you cut the cake. And so, you know, I think I've been fortunate to speak to Jacques a couple times. And so, but not a lot, but I would say that he has a very nuanced and kind of both, he mixes philosophical and just a really, really, really deep view of it. And I think that's good, because it is a deep issue. And so I shared that with him, but at the same time, I do understand why, people like Chris Mellon, Lou Elizondo, or other people bring this up when you talk about threat. I often tell people they forget, they always leave that in the threat out, which is threat potential.
Yeah.
And so that just means there's potential for the threat. And so when you talk about that, I do understand it, but I also relate more to maybe the Lou Elizondo world or the military defense world, where you look at threat potential. And what that means is that it doesn't matter if every UAP sighting that we've ever had up to this point is non-threatening. The potential for not whatever it is that's been up to this point to do something threatening, that doesn't mean that's the threat. Rather, the potential exists out there that something is this highly advanced and capable. And so, if one can do it, more can. And so that means that the potential out there, the Klingons show up one day and they start bombing. Maybe the threat isn't really here, but the potential for you to have this advanced technology or this advanced capability, if that exists, it can potentially be used against you by even unknown actors that haven't even entered the picture. And that's where people in the defense, national security, that's what their job is. Their job is, especially when you look at people like Chris or Lou, who they're intelligence people, the unknown is super scary for them, because the unknown, you hate when you're an intelligence, by definition, intelligent means you want to be intelligently informed on things. And when you don't know something, ignorance is frightening and terrifying. And so I understand where they say that. I would, I can't speak on behalf of them, but I would just say my interpretation is, I would hope people don't get too hung up on that and believe that that means, that they're encouraging or anybody's encouraging, we need to develop weapons and shoot them the hell out of the sky. I don't think that in that sense. But, at the same time, if, when people talk about abduction experiences, if these are real events and these are happening, and when I say if, that doesn't mean that I don't believe when people share their experiences. But it's just, there's such a subjective experience that, it's hard to kind of quantify that in the world that I work in, but I don't discount them. But, that idea that something could take you against your will, it's a crime if human beings do that. And so, if something else is able to do that, I guess it would be up to each individual. Is that a threat to you? If something could take you from your home and, do whatever they want at will? I think a lot of people would say yes, that I don't want that to happen. So I think it's just nuanced. I wouldn't put it in any category. And kind of recapping to how we started the conversation, talking about psychology, perception, and consciousness, we may just very well lack the language to define a whole lot that's going on with this right now, and we're just struggling to do the best we can by using words like threat and anything else, tic-tac. I doubt that whatever it is calls it a tic-tac. We use language to relate it, and so that we can convey knowledge amongst each other without experience. And so if we were talking about something quote non-human, we have to accept it's inherently alien, and we can't subscribe human thoughts, beliefs, and potential to it. We just kind of got to roll with it.
Tim, you've been more than generous with your time. Is there anything else you want to say before we wrap up here?
Oh, Jay, man, it was a lot of fun. I truly appreciate you inviting me to come on, and would be happy anytime. It's great chatting with you. The debrief.org, that's the website, and we'll be putting out new articles, and, it's not just a UAP site, so please don't anybody get mad because there's not enough UFO coverage, but we will do it, and we are going to do it responsibly, and also, provide a venue for some of those invisible college, and I don't mean the classical sense like the Jacques Vallées and people, but I mean maybe some of these other professionals out here that if they do want to discuss that kind of stuff, they have an outlet to write with. And so, check us out there. And, obviously you can get a hold of us there. My emails are on there, our emails are on there. And so maybe people have, ideas about emerging technology, science, technology, or maybe this UAP subject that you feel like should be examined more, By all means, please drop us a line. And for me in particular, this is going to be great because now I can go back to kind of some of the things that really interest me and do a yeah. lot more on the whole consciousness topic. So.
Well, that could be a whole other conversation for me and you one day, because I could talk for hours on end about the consciousness side of the phenomena. But I want to thank you for your responses and your continued efforts in pushing this subject into the forefront. You know, we're all in this together and we all want to see a world where this subject is commonplace. And so once again, thank you for being here and also for doing what you do. And also check out the debrief, everyone.